Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Dugout Debate Podcast. I am Chris Kerr and let me introduce who else I am on with today. The man that will do most of the talking on this episode is Tim Husselbury, which I'll explain why later. Then we also have our North American correspondent who's across the pond in Philadelphia, Will Barrett. So why is Tim going to do even more talking in this episode than he normally does?
God, that's a good effort if I can manage that.
Well, that's because this week we're talking about the Christian Eriksen cardiac arrest in Denmark's opening game of the European Championships. And Tim is somewhat of an expert in this field, aren't you, Tim?
Apparently.
So what exactly happened to Christian Eriksen? So on the 12th of June, while playing in Denmark's opening group stage game against Finland in the Parken Stadium in Copenhagen, Christian Eriksen collapsed in the 42nd minute as he was about to receive a throw-in. Urgent medical assistance arrived immediately. CPR and defibrillation was performed on the field before Eriksen was taken off the pitch on a stretcher and the match was suspended. Around an hour after the incident, UEFA and the Danish Football Association officials confirmed that Eriksen had been stabilised and was awake. The match continued later that evening, resulting in a 1-0 victory for Finland, with Eriksen chosen by UEFA as the man of the match. The next day, the Danish team doctor, Morten Boesen, confirmed Eriksen had suffered a cardiac arrest, and the incident itself drew comparisons to Fabrice Muamba and Abdelhak Nouri, two professional footballers who had also collapsed during play in similar circumstances, with the latter suffering permanent brain damage due to the incident. The following day, it was announced that Eriksen would be fitted with an implantable cardioverter defibrillator device, a decision described by Boesen as necessary due to rhythm disturbances following his cardiac arrest. And on the 18th of June, the Danish Football Association declared that Eriksen had undergone a successful operation and was discharged from hospital. So guys, what were our emotional reactions to the incident? I'll start with you, Will.
Just one of shock and horror, really. You know, this is always a very distressing thing to witness. Obviously, made worse by the reactions of the broadcaster, which we'll get to later on. But you know, you can't help but think about, you know, your friend, your own friends and family, and seeing the reaction of Eriksen's wife in the stands was, you know, just deeply distressing. And I don't really think there's a lot more to say other than just, you know, thank God he's okay, and thank God he's pulled through.
Yeah, I didn't actually see the incident live myself as I was working at a match, but I knew something big had happened as my girlfriend was texting me about the match, possibly the first time ever she's texted me about something to do with football. I watched the footage later on, and it was really difficult to watch someone suffering with something so major publicly in front of thousands of people in the stands and millions around the world on TV. And I think everyone watching was obviously really shaken by it. What were your reactions to it, Tim?
It's quite tricky because I have a sort of inherent curiosity with all this kind of stuff. So as soon as something like this happens, I'm like, ooh, why? So I think it's very easy, not very easy. And I'm not desensitized. I think those are the wrong words, but my brain probably doesn't go to the same places that a lot of people do. And I think your reaction, Will, is undeniably human and the correct one. You know, thinking about friends and family and all that kind of stuff. Because my initial thought is like, oh, why is this happening and what are they doing? And but I think, to be honest, my thinking not very long after the event was, this is actually a bloody good story in terms of it's a good story. It's not like a tragedy. Obviously, it's terrible for his career and this kind of stuff, and we'll get onto that later. And, you know, a man had a cardiac arrest on the field and millions of people watched a man get shocked and had CPR. And none of this is actually good. But the fact that he was awake by the time he left the pitch, sort of 7 or 8 minutes after he went down, is phenomenal. Like, the survival from out of hospital cardiac arrests is dreadful, sort of even today. So the fact that, you know, he was back and awake and clearly conscious by the time he left the pitch was excellent. I think my emotions from it, like, have changed sort of listening to reaction and reading reaction since. And you know, I think I've engaged more with the human side of it. Not to say that I wasn't at the time. It's just I was thinking other things rather than, you know, the intensely, deeply emotional aspect. But certainly listen to, say, the Guardian Football Weekly, you know, they were all completely cut up about it and could barely string a sentence together without having a little cry. Like, damn it! I'm like, this is scary. It is fundamentally scary, even for somebody who, you know, kind of gets what's going on. Yeah, I'll stop babbling.
So, because you look at it from a slightly different view, Tim, can you kind of explain medically what happened to Ericsson and what they did in the aftermath? We have to say that there was incredible speed of reaction from all the medical people there. But what exactly happened, and what did they do to help him?
So we're recording this without like actual information about Christian's condition. So I'm going to try, like, at least now, I'm not going to speculate as to what it is. I think later on the podcast, I'll try and talk about the kind of conditions that could lead to this, especially in young people. But Christian had a cardiac arrest. Just to clarify kind of the difference between a heart attack and a cardiac arrest. Yeah. Because those terms are used interchangeably, and I noticed on the Danish FA's statement in the aftermath, they said he had a cardiac attack, which is really unhelpful, because what is it? Is that a heart attack, a cardiac arrest, or something?
Yeah, weird, mixture of the two.
And then again, I'm going to caveat all this by saying we don't know exactly the details with Christian, but we can speculate given what we've been told so far. So a heart attack, we'll start with that first because it's the least relevant. A heart attack is where the arteries that supply your heart with blood, so the actual heart muscle itself, is like any muscle, it needs oxygen to survive. That is delivered in the blood. And that a heart attack is where those arteries get blocked for whatever reason. So it could be a clot that's gone and formed from somewhere else, but most likely it's due to a thickening of the artery, the insides of the arteries themselves, because of, you know, just fat deposits over lifetime and that kind of thing. And eventually it narrows and narrows and narrows until you get to a point that the artery gets blocked. So the bit below, the muscle below where the blockage is, no longer gets any blood. So that starts to die. And that's the heart attack bit, right? So that part of the muscle is not getting enough oxygen, it starts to die. So the job in a heart attack is to open the vessels, resupply that bit of the heart with blood, and hopefully stop it from dying. Okay. So people who have really big heart attacks then have heart muscles that don't work properly. If it's not treated quick enough, then they get heart failure and all that kind of stuff, because the heart can't pump blood efficiently like it should do. So that's not what happened here. This was a cardiac arrest. So a heart attack is plumbing. Think of it like the plumbing. Cardiac arrests are electrics. So essentially it's where the normal conduction pathway of the heart, instead of being normal and organized and sort of, it's all very clever and all designed so you have the most efficient heartbeat that you can every second or so, or every half a second or whatever, or if you're exercising every third of a second, it's all organized in a coherent top to bottom sort of fashion to make sure that the blood goes out the heart like it should do. A cardiac arrest is where the electrics go haywire, essentially. And instead of beating in a nice coordinated fashion, the muscle fibers either twitch way too fast independently of one another. So that's like fibrillation. So each muscle fiber is just kind of like wibbling, if you like. And with that, you wouldn't actually get any cardiac output. You wouldn't get the blood leaving the heart, really. So that's why people tend to collapse. Or you get something like ventricular tachycardia, when the heart is pumping so fast from an abnormal rhythm that's generated at the bottom of the heart that essentially it can't fill quick enough to be able to eject enough blood. So heart attack is a plumbing issue, heart muscle dies, cardiac arrest, electrics issue, where the heart isn't contracting properly and therefore can't get enough blood out of the heart to the rest of the body. And of course, the important part of that is that if you're not getting blood out, it's not going to the places where it's needed, most specifically the brain, which is why you pass out, because passing out is a very clever way of the body going, oh no, we're getting enough blood to the brain, let's try and get gravity out the way. So you hit the deck to try and help your heart out as much as you can. That's what happened here. So the immediate consideration when you've got somebody who's had a cardiac arrest is A, detecting it, which is not always the easiest thing. Generally, if they're not breathing, can't feel a pulse, CPR is what you need to do. So cardiopulmonary resuscitation, essentially it's you take over the job of the heart before you can sort of fix the electrics issue. So this is almost exclusively done when you have a cardiac arrest. I'll just take it back one step, because you can have a cardiac arrest off the back of a heart attack. So they kind of are intertwined, but if we just sort of try and separate them just for the ease of this, because Christian almost certainly did not have a heart attack because he's young and fit. Yeah, CPR takes over, you essentially, as the person doing CPR, take over the job of the heart, trying to pump that blood out to try and maintain oxygen delivery to the brain and all the places that's needed. Prompt CPR, doing it as soon as you can when you recognize that somebody's, you know, had a cardiac arrest, is essential. And I think this was the first brilliant bit of this whole situation and why it's such a good story, because we saw Simon Kerr go straight over and was just like, he was doing the correct medical things, like moving Christian onto his side so he didn't swallow his tongue or whatever. And then the whole team recognizing quite quickly that he had had a cardiac arrest and then immediately starting CPR. Brilliant, you know, brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. So then the question is, what do you do next? Because, you know, you can't do CPR forever. You've got to do something to get the heart out of that rhythm and into like what's effectively a normalish rhythm. In this case, it's, well, in any case, essentially, it's defibrillation. So you remember how I said the muscle fibers in the heart were fibrillating and therefore not pumping blood out properly or efficiently. The idea is that you shock the heart, reset the electrics, and then hopefully it goes back into the normal conduction pathway that it should have done before. The success of defibrillating can really vary. I think they said they only did one shock on Christian and they got the pulse back, which is brilliant. And this was all within the space of, you know, what was it, 3 or 4 minutes? So yeah, that's kind of the story. And they obviously got a pulse back and he was awake and conscious within a few minutes. So it was clearly effective. But we'll go into the sort of the why in a bit.
Yeah.
But the real take home, I think, like while we're still relatively early on in the rambles of an insane man, the take home is CPR and defibrillation. Like whenever anyone can learn how to do those, CPR, it's tough. Like it's really hard. If you've ever done it, you know, a minute and a half, maybe. And you're completely gassed. So doing it, yes. Identifying that you need help, yes. And knowing where your nearest defibrillator is, or getting somebody to go find one, / getting an ambulance. And the defibrillators that you find in public, the ones on train station walls, literally a 5-year-old could use it. They are designed so 5-year-olds could use them. So, you know, two very well educated lads like yourselves, I'm sure, could definitely manage. But if there's any takeaway from this, it's go off and learn how to do CPR. Look out for AEDs or defibrillators. Just have a look near where you live. See if you can sort of send somebody in that direction if you are anywhere on your normal route. And like that will save somebody's life. Like the chances of somebody listening to this having to deal with somebody who's having a cardiac arrest or even a heart attack. But, you know, like I've said, heart attack can lead to cardiac arrest, so it's important to know where in your local vicinity there is one. So anyway, yeah, I ramble. He had a cardiac arrest. They gave him CPR. They defibrillated him out of that rhythm, so they got him awake again.
Obviously, we saw all of this happen on TV, and my question to you, Will, is should we have seen that, or should the TV director have cut away earlier and realised what was happening earlier? I know it's an unusual occurrence, but should he reacted differently to it?
Well, I mean, so obviously the answer is no, we shouldn't have seen that. It's a very, very personal, very traumatic moment for Christian and his family, despite the fact that it happened in a very public place in a football arena. Whoever made the call to keep doing it were probably caught between a rock and a hard place. They probably had this dilemma going on, and whether they kept the viewers, whether they let them go. Now, my view is that they obviously should have let them go, and people would have gone and found that elsewhere, and that would have been fine. Not fine, but, you know, let them go. But, yeah, I don't think that anybody needed to see that at all. And to the point where we saw, you know, the footballers form shield wall around them. You know, this is obviously something that is not for public viewing.
Ultimately, what we're saying then is that the director or whoever made the decision had enough different camera angles that even if he didn't go back to the studio, he could have cut to more crowd shots, which he did do some of, but even more crowd shots or different shots to actually showing Christian on the floor with his, the most harrowing shot for me out of the whole lot was his face not breathing, pale as anything, on the floor, completely lifeless. We didn't need to see that shot. And then obviously the players then formed the ring, as you say, around him after that. Mainly, I suppose, to stop the crowd seeing anything as well, not even thinking that TV are going to be showing it at that point.
Yeah.
But yeah, what did you make of it, Tim, and the TV kind of reaction to it?
Yeah, I think, like, ethically, there's a lot going on here to unpack. Certainly, if I was a TV director, I'd have bailed out there quite quickly, and I'm not, so I'm not aware of all the stakeholders that are involved in making that type of decision. So, you know, I'm sure whoever it was is not a malicious person or... but it's probably not the decision that I would have made. I particularly think that there was, you crossed the line when you zoomed in on his wife.
Yeah.
I think there's one thing panning around the crowd and trying to just like move on with the broadcast in some way, but it turned it into a bit of a pantomime with focusing on his wife. And I think when you become a patient, you have the right to confidentiality, as do your family, essentially. And that breached that immediately.
Yeah.
That is to say, I am not... I've got to word this quite carefully. I think that public service-wise, this event has done quite a lot of good.
Yeah.
And, like, it happened, right? We can't go back and change what was shown. And I think a lot of people had their eyes open to just the process.
Yeah.
And without this... error of judgment from whoever it was decision making with the broadcast, I think that wouldn't have been quite so evident or quite so profound and sort of deeply emotive.
Yeah.
So I'm upset that it happened, but also I think we can take a lot of a positive slant from it.
Yeah.
Given the education that it has had, the education journey it's sent people upon.
Yeah.
But again, I wouldn't. You know, I wouldn't advocate for this move the first place. And frankly, you know, the correct move was just take it to one of the helicopter shots outside of the stadium, or just can the broadcast and leave it to the local providers to just do whatever they need to. Because when they went back to the studio, Ned Four completely sort of shocked and frankly traumatized presenters, like, oh, now it's your turn to deal with it. Like, come on, man, just... cut to country file or something.
Just to move it on slightly, we've done a podcast on this type of incident previously. And off the back of the Fabrice Muamba incident, what type of tests do footballers now do to try and prevent this from happening, or picking it up before this happens in a football match, Tim?
I'm not convinced that the landscape of screening has changed like loads. You know, we're 9 years down the line from that. The tests themselves have stayed the same broadly. The quality of the tests might have improved, like the images that you can take with certain tests are much better, so you can see the heart structure better. And our understanding of the diseases that that can cause these kind of events has come on sort of exponentially over the 9 years. I'll break down a few tests that we do. So the first is the ECG, or the electrocardiogram. Really, that is the bread and butter of cardiac testing. It's a test that allows you to look at the electrical conduction of the heart at rest or during exercise or during the day. So I think, like, a lot of people listening to this, if they've not had an ECG, they'll definitely know somebody who has. And a lot of people would even have had like the 24-hour version of an ECG that you take home, you wear, and then you bring it back the next day and we look at it and let you know what's going on with your rhythm. So yeah, the ECG is a really, really, really powerful test, because if it's abnormal, you will be escalated for further testing. And if it's normal, it doesn't rule out necessarily cardiac problems, but it's very useful on the way to suggesting that it's probably not too bad. So that's the ECG. The next test is an echocardiogram, or an echo, as we more often refer to it as, and sorry about all the abbreviations, you're going to have a lot of those today. So the echo is like a baby scan, except we're not looking for babies, we're looking for hearts. Hopefully we find one, and then we look at the structure and the function of the heart. So all the valves, the sizes of the chambers, how the heart is pumping, what the blood flow's like, all this kind of stuff. So again, the echo is a really, really powerful test. It's in young people with who are sort of relatively slim and well built. It's a really beautiful, it can be really beautiful test. The pictures you can get are really nice. In slightly older people, it can be an absolute nightmare. Diseases that are associated with cardiac problems like lung disease make imaging really difficult. So it can be a brilliant test. It can be difficult, but I think in this athlete demographic, it's really useful, and you can get a lot of information from you can do various versions of this test. You can do it at rest, which is the normal one, but you can also get people on a bike and do it while they're exercising to see how the heart responds. And then the final one really is an exercise tolerance test, or an ETT. And you put the electrodes, the ECG on again. You stick them on a treadmill or on a bike, get them to work as hard as they can. It's a maximal effort test, get them all the way up or close to maximum effort. See what their heart rate does, see what happens to the conduction patterns. There's various complex things that you can look for, but essentially you're just seeing what happens with the ECG. Another variant of this test is a cardiopulmonary exercise test, where you stick a face mask on them and you can work out their like exercise tolerance and give some numbers to things. But broadly speaking, how well does your body respond to exercise, and does anything funny happen to your heart? So those are the three major things that we kind of think about. And you definitely will have seen in all sort of transfer news, a man with a load of stickers on with a thumbs up. Like, Real Madrid are infamous for this. And frankly, like, the images are quite funny, because from a technical standpoint, the stickers on these, you know, multi-million pound players are in completely the wrong place. It's hilarious. So anyway, so those are the three main tests that we do to screen for athletes. And it's been that way for a little while. There are more complicated tests that you can do, but they are reserved primarily for when there's a degree of suspicion of something being wrong and you want to sort of...
So my follow-up question to that would be, why would these tests not prevent the Ericsson incident from happening? But I guess that would be because he wouldn't show any abnormality from the actual test. Is that right?
Right. So this is where it's really complicated. So buckle in. Like, please stop me if I go too far, because it's difficult to get from like a professional's point of view sometimes this. So I will start by talking about the typical diseases that we're looking for in athletes, because I think that allows you to think more broadly about why we find it difficult down the line. Essentially, the heart, like I said, is like any other muscle and needs oxygen to survive. But like any other muscle, you train it, it will improve to be able to allow you to perform whatever action it is you're doing better. So the heart might get a little bit thicker, the chambers might get a bit bigger, which is a good thing. It means that you can pump a bit harder when you're exercising. You can fill the heart a bit more to pump more blood out when you're exercising. So both of those two things combined, bigger chamber, more blood can get in and out. Slightly thicker heart, more forceful contraction, more blood can get out of the heart when you're exercising. Of course, at rest, their hearts might look more sluggish because it's not making an effort, because it's like up here.
Yeah.
I've just got to get the blood out. I'm not even doing anything. It's fine. So that's what happens to an athlete. Going back to the diseases that we're thinking about. So the main diseases from an athletic standpoint that we're concerned about are called cardiomyopathies. So break the world down. Cardio, heart, myo, muscle, and then pathies, disorder kind of thing. So put them all together, heart muscle disorders, right? And these are inherited conditions, predominantly, which alter the structure and the function of the heart pathologically, not physiologically, pathologically. Physiological is good and normal, again, most of the time. And pathological is bad and not normal, obviously. this is hard. So the things we're thinking about particularly, and the ways these diseases manifest themselves in people who definitely have the disease, are thicker hearts, abnormally thicker hearts, and abnormally big chambers, right? So you're seeing the problem already, okay? We've got this group of people who have thicker hearts and or bigger chambers, who are super physiologically adapted and are like at the prime basically the apex of humanity. And you've got this group of people who have thickened hearts and bigger chambers and are at greater risk of dying. And sometimes those Venn diagrams overlap. So the cutoffs for disease versus adaptation are super debated, like super debated. And being able to tell what's pathological versus physiological, or adaptation versus pathological, I could try and keep it to adaptation because I think that sounds nicer. Adaptation versus pathological is really difficult and nuanced. And there are lots of papers from really good people who debate this and have very valid scientific reasons for all this kind of stuff, and they're not sure. We're at this point with the science that we know enough that we don't know yet. So what does that actually mean? Right? Because we won't change the tests we do. And a lot of this stuff would normally be guided by symptoms. And if the athlete starts feeling weird or whatever, they would be escalated for more tests and that kind of thing. Big thing that you probably want to do for these guys is you'd want to detrain them and see what happens. If you had suspicion about it, you would detrain them, see what happens to their heart. If it goes like towards normal, that's good because it means it's probably adaptation. But if it doesn't, you're like, oh dear, maybe this isn't. So luckily we're in a world where genetic testing has exploded in the last 10 years. And I think it's difficult to sort of portray how much of an impact this will have on medicine moving forward. Like, you can have a blood test and within a week or two, you can look at the entire genome of a given person and see if there's anything weird in there. And then even better than that, if there's anything weird, you can compare it to all the other tests that have ever been done on somebody, on other people, and like see if there's a link with that disease. And if there's not, you might be the first one that we found. So like, this is super cool. So you could do that, for instance, in a trained person. But the this is where the ethics of this kind of stuff comes into it. Do you want to be doing genetic tests on any athletes? I don't know, maybe. Do they want it? They might not want it. And then the other thing is, you can't ask an athlete to detrain. You just can't do it. Like,
yeah.
I think they'd have to be super symptomatic and not at the level they were at before to consider it. On the whole, it's an unreasonable expectation of an athlete when they're fine. And I don't think, I think most of the time they're fine, which is another sort of barrier.
Yeah, that's answered it pretty well. My kind of follow-up from that, which you've answered, but I want to kind of go into a bit more depth on, is obviously the professional athlete has therefore trained their body to be fitter, and has it made their heart fitter therefore? As you've said, with the chambers and the thickening of the wall, does that mean they're less likely to get an incident like this happening because their heart is fitter, or because they're pushing their body to the limit at the top of physical performance during a match, are they more likely to get an incident like this?
Like, if they're adapted and well-trained, I think the answer to that is no, they're not as likely. Or at least they're just like as likely as anyone else. The real problem comes with if they have got a disease, then it is an issue that they're doing so much work, because it makes it even more likely that one of these dangerous rhythms will fire off because of the complicated pathological process that goes on. I'm not going to go into details, but essentially the heart is remodeled in such a way that it's not like, it's not how it should be. And therefore the likelihood of you setting off one of these rhythms from an area that shouldn't be generating a rhythm because it's formed incorrectly is higher. And one of the triggers for that is stressing the heart.
Yeah. Anything else to add, Will, at that point or not?
Well, I was just kind of curious as to, and obviously you may or may not know the answer to this, but is it necessarily different according to what type of exercise you do? So, for example, the difference between top-class professional footballers and the difference between, you know, Tour de France cyclist versus, you know, an Olympic weightlifter. Obviously, they are all incredibly super fit in their own way. But for example, is the Olympic weightlifter more or less at risk, perhaps, than, you know, the Tour de France cyclist, because it's not necessarily as much cardiovascular strain on the body?
You're clearly a scientist at heart, Will, because those are like several brilliant questions. So yes, to your first one about the heart adapts differently in accordance with the exercise modality or the exercise type that you And that makes a lot of sense, right? Because there's no point being super aerobically fit if you're a weightlifter. So for them, you might have a slightly thicker heart because you're dealing with higher pressures, because when they lift all this weight, you know, you're tense and you're like, So your heart has to be able to kind of deal with that. Whereas, you know, maybe a Tour de France cyclist is more, will have bigger chambers because they've got to, you know, pump out more blood because they're working so hard for every sort of minute. But they don't want a really thick heart because that would be, that requires more energy to run. Sort of thing. So like there's a lot of complex physiology going in here, which are the reasons why they adapt. But the answer to that is yes. The answer to the question about whether or not different athlete groups are more or less risk is more complicated. But I think that the kind of take home message is, if you're doing anything strenuously and you've got one of these diseases, you should be thinking twice. I think like there are guidance on sort of the kind of sports that you could get away with, say golf, for instance, and this kind of thing. That would be like sort of further down the spectrum of strenuosity. But I think just it's easier just to think of it, if you're doing anything to a top class level, I would count that as strenuous. So let's try and avoid it. Like, there is medical literature which details it, and I'm not the expert on that. So, you know, people who are interested will find it. But yes is the answer, but it's nuanced.
Cool. So my next question off the back of that is, how likely is it that we will see more incidents like these in top class sport?
Thankfully, it's super rare. I don't think that it will become more likely necessarily. We are certainly hearing more about these things. And I think that's a luxury afforded to us by the, you know, globalization and brilliant communication, being able to be on the button every second. And also we have a much better understanding of what kills people with these diseases. And, you know, autopsies can really help. And, you know, sort of one of the diseases that was the focus of my project while training is like thick hearts. And that was first described. I'll ask you so you can do some speaking. When do you reckon this like thick heart syndrome was first described? Abnormally thick heart syndrome.
70s or 80s?
I'm gonna go super recent. I'm gonna sound really stupid, but I'm gonna go like 2011.
Okay. So no, not that recent. It was 1958. You think about the first heart transplant was around that time. So, you know, or give or take 10 years here or there. It's really recent, really recent. So the fact that we've gone from knowing literally nothing in 1957 to in 2021, having lots of tests, really good awareness of treatment, you know, all this kind of stuff now is phenomenal. This is all numbers when you boil it down. And it just so happens these guys became professional athletes. But, you know, we've got plenty of people who walk around with these diseases and you might not find out till later life because they've never got their heart to a point where it's fired off or the disease wasn't severe enough. Then equally, you get people who have a really severe disease at a young age. So, you know, it's all complicated. But no, I don't think it'll become more likely necessarily.
Will, did you want to ask your Qatar World Cup question or would you rather not?
No, I think mainly Tim has answered what I was going to say in terms of, you know, does the more and more football that these guys do increase the likelihood of these incidents happening? But based on your answer to the previous question, I'm going to go no. I'm going to say no. But my other question was sort of around as these guys are coming up and through the academy systems and as their bodies are developing, and whether it would be perhaps possible, as devastating as it would be for that individual to be told that, you know, a career as as a professional athlete is not viable for them, whether it would be possible to perhaps catch these things earlier, or whether it's the variance is so small and they look relatively similar, whether that's just a pipe dream for now.
So there is an enormous amount of debate about the value of screening, not just in cardiac disease, but in sort of lots of diseases, like doing general body scans for cancers and, you know, blood tests and genetic tests and all this kind of stuff. And you can literally order them by post, send them off, and then somebody will give you some sort of percentages as to how likely you are to have this disease at some point in your life. Ethically, it's like an absolute minefield, because the success of screening is pretty poor on the whole for actual live diseases. There have been a lot of studies, especially in Italy, where I think they looked at, you know, 10,000 athletes or something crazy, and looked at ECGs, and they broke down sort of like these were the normal ones and then these were the variants and all this kind of stuff. And like, I think of the 10,000, four had their careers ended by the ECG that they had done or whatever. I read that paper a while ago, so I can't remember the nuance, but essentially like 4 out of 10,000 is not a fantastic hit rate. We'll class that as severe disease or serious enough disease to be reconsidering things. And also there's a problem with over-testing and being over-cautious with stuff. How much is variance of normal? How much is, you know, do we need to know? Because a lot of people get on fine without them. How much is it going to change in the future? Are there sort of, will this label that they have of having like a slightly different heart to normal, but not like a necessarily badly pathological heart, how much is that going to affect their career? Like, there's so much going on here. So that's the screening side of it. That's not to say it doesn't happen, and I think it's important that it does, especially in an athletic population. The pediatrics / adolescent into adulthood kind of genre is not something I'm entirely familiar with. But again, this will be guided by the medical opinion and the tests that they undergo. Like 99% of them, I'm sure, will be normal. But the 1% will require a little bit of thinking, a little bit of probably surveillance is what the way they'd move forward. And I think the important thing to think about when you're talking about younger athletes, especially, is that these diseases that I'm talking about don't necessarily express themselves from like minute one, as in minute one of life rather than minute one of a football match. So these things can only start to have a tangible, visible effect on the heart like deep into your 60s kind of thing. That's not to say that in someone else with the same genetic defect, in inverted commas, it could happen earlier. Like, our understanding of this is pretty poor when the disease presents itself and all this kind of thing. So like, the screening is not necessarily valuable because of that reason, because it's not shown itself yet. And you're not going to send somebody off for genetic screening if you don't have any real reason to. Like, predominantly you send somebody for genetic screening if you're not sure. And I think it's less likely that that will be the case in younger people. Like, I'm talking particularly young, 16.
So taking this back full circle, back to Christian Eriksen, where does this leave his career? I guess it's a bit complicated for us because we're kind of speculating exactly what condition he has. But he has now been fitted with one of these devices. So what's the next steps for him?
My hunch is that if it is, and this is only a hunch, I'm kind of assuming it's one of these cardiomyopathies or heart muscle disorder diseases that he had. It could have been like an electrical thing. That is sort of out of my comfort zone because I'm not an electrician. I'm a plumber by trade, a cardiac plumber. Not even that. I look at the plumbing. I don't do it. the electric side of it is something I'm like less comfortable with. So if it was a purely electric disorder, I can't really speak for it. But if it was one of these cardiomyopathies, it would be unlikely he'd be able to return to a professional sport.
Cool. That answers that pretty well. Anything else to add, Will, at this point, or are you happy?
I'm pretty happy. I just you mentioned earlier about the 2022 World Cup, and so my question would then be, you know, going forward, what would you change? What would you hope to change, perhaps, for in terms of response time, in terms of testing, and for the Qatar 2020 Qatar World Cup? You know, obviously they're going to be playing in you know, extreme conditions. What that might look like for, you know, as additional stress on the heart, and if you can make any perhaps recommendations, just in case anybody is listening who has any sway.
Yeah, sure. sure. Yeah, I'm not sure my word is going to sway anything. But the so again, really good points to have made. 2022 is contentious for a number of reasons, but the heat factor is. So I'm kind of speculating, but physiologically, I think it makes sense that it's more stressful for the athletes, without doubt. And managing their fatigue is going to be really important. Managing their diet is going to be really important. And so logically, it makes sense to me that this would be an enhanced stressor. And if you would avoid somebody to or tell somebody to avoid doing strenuous exercise, I would imagine that this is probably the most strenuous form of exercise you can have. So whether or not that makes it more likely that somebody with a disease that's hidden would have an event in this context, I don't know, potentially. But in terms of tangible changes from a cardiac point of view, that this tournament being held there makes, I'm not convinced there's a lot. Other than watch their fluid intake and make sure they're not, that, you know, you're having the drinks breaks and all this kind of stuff, and, you know, they recover well, and you monitor them and respond to not necessarily the athletes themselves, obviously the athletes themselves, and they're quoting their own fatigue levels, but also physiologically, what are you seeing in training? Are they getting up to the heights they need to, or are they showing signs of burnout? Because I think all this stuff is sort of like you need to step back. And I would like to see the full roster bench and five-man subs continued for 2022. I think that would be very sensible. It will not happen because of that reason. I think the proof of this is the success of this particular story that we did learn from what happened in 2012. And I think the athletes now recognize this as a potential danger. And they are the ones who are on the field and can make the quickest decision as to what's going on with the player. And they know without a doubt when something's serious, you know, Pepe flapping around on the floor. Like, they're not concerned about him, but Eriksen going down trying to receive a throw in, that was terrifying. So I think we're in a pretty good place on the professional side of things, especially in football, with cardiac stuff. Concussion, we've spoken about a lot, and frankly, the Pavard versus Germany is diabolical.
Yeah.
But again, this is for another time. No, our thoughts are clear on that. Like, there's not a chance in hell he should have been on the pitch. He met the ground with not an arm, but his nose.
Yeah.
You cannot say for a second he was knocked out. And you don't even need to be knocked out to have a concussion. And, you know, you're not necessarily concussed if you're knocked out. But anyway, sorry. I don't. Yeah. It's not necessarily the professional, like uber professional side of the game that I'm worried about. It's more like, you know, you League One, you League Two, grassroots kind of football. What are we doing there? Where are the defibrillators there? Where are the medical professionals? And my honest answer is I don't know, because I don't know the landscape well enough. But I would hazard guess that if the same thing happened, the medical response would not be quite so swift.
Yeah.
And those first 10 minutes are the most important ones. You know, if you're having a cardiac arrest and if you're not starting CPR, and frankly, if you're not getting a defibrillation down in like your first one done quickly, your chances of survival are not great. So that's what I'm wondering about. And I think this has the potential to be a real sea change kind of moment. I'm not asking for footballers to stump up the cash themselves. Like, this is not where I'm going, but the cache for the tree further down for these kind of things, which are, it's not, this is not politics, this is lives, right? You buy one of these and it gets used once and it works, you know, you there's no life, there's yeah. no yeah, but there is no cost to that,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
There is no, you can't put a number
yeah,
on that.
Priceless.
Like, it's a couple of thousand. What's a couple of thousand when you've got a life? And even if it doesn't work, even if the person does die, like, doesn't matter.
They gave it the best shot.
And you're buying time for the medics to get there, the ambulance to get there. So that's where we need to sort of jump on the bandwagon of this. And I think that it's Christian Eriksen specifically as a footballer is really interesting, like, because the way his career has gone and the clubs he's been at, Ajax, which obviously had Nouri and his cardiac arrest, Tottenham, a well-known English club, Inter, a giant Italian club, and Denmark, who are, you know, a reasonably well-respected nation and were predicted to do things at this tournament, at least proceed, and all in the context of the entire world watching, like, never has all these things kind of very high profile player who's been at very big club, well, Spurs and some very big clubs on literally the global stage. Never have we had this coalescent of sort of perfect storm, makes it sound like you kind of want this to happen, but obviously we don't. If it's going to happen, you kind of want it to be boom, like boom, oh God. you want it to be obvious and shocking. And no, you don't. No, you know what I'm saying.
I know exactly
though, right?
What you're saying.
I'm really trying not to sound
if
like
it's going to happen to anyone, you want it to happen on the world stage so that it makes a bigger impact and has a better.
You want lessons to be learned by everyone.
Yes.
You don't, yeah. So I think this has a potential to be really good for life generally. And there's such easy changes you can make, even if it's like every sports pitch has a defibrillator or every sports pitch has the nearest, like, this is where the nearest one is on XX Street. You go left here and right here. You know, that, you know, 2 minutes extra trying to find where the thing is because it's not clearly signed. That's the difference between life and death here. So
I take it there are no websites that do that kind of stuff at the moment. Oh, there are.
So I think if you Google it.
Yeah.
Shall I try it now?
Yeah, go for it now.
I don't know.
Give it a go and see what comes up.
Yeah, so Google Maps is giving me AED stuff.
Oh, that's good.
It's probably not nearest defibrillator to me would be probably a better thing to type.
Yes.
Because obviously I know what AED stands for. Automated external defibrillator. And the difference with those is you stick it on and the thing tells you what to do.
Yeah.
Whereas like a normal defibrillator, you kind of need to know how to read an ECG and what to do. But anyway, so AEDs are what you would find.
Yeah,
and they are at train stations. Pretty much every train station will definitely have one. Your shops or outside major shops. What other good places? Some bus stops have them. Like when you look for them, you see them. Like they're in a green box and they've got a big bolt with it's a heart with a bolt in the middle, as far as I can remember. They're super obvious. Just know where they are.
And what other places would you recommend people to go to? You mentioned Cry when we were on before.
Sure. So Cardiac Risk and Young are a fantastic group. They offer screening for young people who want to go and get their heart checked. So it's an ECG. So you're checking your electrics, and then that can be followed up with an echo if they deem it necessary, and you will be reviewed by, you know, expert scientists, expert medics, who will be able to talk through all these kind of things with you and sort of relax you a bit. A final point I want to make about Christian Eriksen before we sort of start wrapping up is that there has been a little bit of talk that I've heard, like, regarding the efficacy of the screening and stuff that he underwent. And obviously I can't speak to his disease, but the Tottenham team are followed up medically, cardiac wise, by arguably the world experts in this field. Like, if I had this disease and I was an athlete, I'd go to them. Or there was a suspicion I had this disease and I was an athlete, I'd go to them. They're obviously experts on these diseases themselves, but in an athletic population, those guys are arguably the world leaders. So there's no question to me that it was at all obvious that he had any disease when he left Tottenham in 2019. That doesn't mean anything. Like, things might have changed down the line, but in terms of structural heart disease, he didn't have it when he left Tottenham, as far as we can tell. Sorry, that was a bit of a digression.
No.
Cardiac Risk in the Young. And the reason why I brought them up is they're kind of like a similar group. Cardiac Risk in the Young and this group are some of the same people.
Yeah.
British Heart Foundation has a lot of information on this kind of stuff. So if you search cardiomyopathy, British Heart Foundation, you'll find some stuff. Just even an NHS website is pretty good. And then also look into first aid training, CPR courses, how to recognize cardiac arrest. Just easy Google, and I'm sure you'll find it within a couple of seconds, of course. Just go and do it. Go and do it. Like, CPR is technically quite easy, theoretically, but doing it for a minute and a half is tough. And if you know how to do it and you're seeing somebody else doing it, go over and give them a hand. So learn how to do it and help. And if you come across somebody and they're not breathing and you've shaken them and you do your first aid thing and they're like not waking up, you get started and you call for help. Like, these are the important things. These quick decisions are what save lives. And it's bloody scary. Like, I'm not sure what I do if I came across somebody in the street. Like, obviously in a hospital setting where we've done this kind of thing, there are rules and you're in a hospital.
Yeah.
It's much easier to sort of, well, it's much easier.
It is a little bit easier.
Yeah. You have defibrillators around the place and all this kind of stuff and all the medicine. But, you know, in out of hospital, the biggest difference makers are the public. So learn how to do it. I can't stress this enough. I said it at the beginning and I'll say it again. Like, just do it. Keep yourself up to date with it. It'll do like half a day, maybe half a weekend. And if you do have to use it, you're like, bloody hell, that was a good Saturday. It was quite sunny, but I'm glad I used it. Like me in the pub.
Am I right in saying, Will, we did a first aid course together while at school? I'm pretty sure.
I think I'm pretty sure we did.
Yeah.
I remember that as well.
Yeah.
But sort of 12 years later.
Yeah, exactly. I might need a top up.
I'm pretty sure I would need a top up at this point. Yeah.
Yeah. Because, like, you do need to do effective CPR.
Yeah.
You can bash the chest quite a lot and not do a lot other than break a leg.
Yeah.
You need to do it. You need to kind of do it right.
Yeah.
To make it worthwhile. Otherwise, you're just going to do a lot of damage and not actually help. But the CPR is, I can't remember if I said this, but CPR is you're buying time to get the defibrillator. Like, you're taking over the work of the heart to buy time to get the defibrillator. So the key is get the defibrillator, but obviously don't leave the patient. So if you're the first one there, shout for help, send them to get a defibrillator. Or if you're already knackered, show them what to do, and then you get the defibrillator. Either way, get the defibrillator.
So thank you very much, everyone, for listening. Don't forget to follow us on social media and come at Tim if you've got any questions. At Dugout.
And if you're a consultant cardiologist, I tried.
Okay. You can find us on social media on Dugout_debate and subscribe to our podcast on all the usual podcast providers. See you again very soon.